So my presentation is titled Getting Comfortable While Getting Tested, Why GBMSM's Reflections on HIV-STI Testing Sites. And this research was conducted in collaboration with Emily Pingle, Alana Butler, Patricia Dittes, and Jose Bauermeister. In the course of the project, I've had no personal, financial, or commercial interest to disclose. So just as some background, as stipulated by the CDC, regular HIV-STI testing for young gay, bi, and other men who have sex with men, or YGBMSM, ages 15 to 24 remains a key HIV-STI prevention strategy nationwide. Yet research has documented that YGBMSM experience widespread discrimination within medical settings due to a lack of LGBTQ sensitivity. It is therefore imperative to explore what factors YGBMSM feel a sense of, or what factors help YGBMSM feel a sense of comfort in testing environments so as to help encourage consistent testing behaviors. So when looking at the HIV epidemic in Michigan, we see that over 75% of HIV cases are diagnosed in the Southeast Michigan area. Over 60% of HIV cases in the Detroit metro area are among men who have sex with men. Over 25% of HIV cases in Michigan are among men who have sex with men who are 13 to 29 years old. And further, when looking at STI incidents, we see that in 2012, 6 out of 9 counties comprising the Southeast Michigan area account for the majority of new chlamydia, gonorrhea, and primary and secondary syphilis cases. Lastly, adolescent and young adult men carry nearly 80% of the syphilis burden among all adolescents and young adults. In order to inform the development of a tailored testing site locator for YGBMSM called Get Connected, 53 HIV-STI testing sites were identified throughout the Southeast Michigan area for evaluation. To do so, each site was visited by 2 secret shoppers at different dates and times. Sites included did not force test clients, did not demand proof of identification, and did not cost more than $60. Other sites not included were identified post-June 2013, or use the same counselor at a mobile site from an HIV-STI agency already identified. Overall, nearly 87% of all testing sites identified were visited. As a method, secret shopping incorporates standardized payment methodology alongside strategies derived from commercial marketing. In implementation, young people employed as shoppers serve as both health consumers and researchers while they evaluate service providers according to recommended guidelines. This methodology has been used to evaluate contraceptive services for youth, community pharmacy consultations, psychiatric services, and alcohol sales to minors. So for Get Connected, 5 racially diverse MPH-level research assistants were enlisted as secret shoppers. Each shopper received training so that they maintained optimal self-efficacy and agency during site visits. Additionally, shoppers were instructed to be forthright about their sexual behaviors during clinical encounters. Immediately after each testing experience, shoppers completed a questionnaire and an open-ended response form, resulting in 97 observations over a 4-month period. Our inquiry focused on these open form responses, and our analysis was guided by a phenomenological framework that emphasized experience. Under the direction of this theoretical approach, we open-coded the data and organized these experiential codes into higher-level content categories in order to create a code hierarchy. With this hierarchy, myself and another colleague focus-coded the data, and upon completion, triangulated our coding code by code. Finally, we conducted a thematic analysis of the coded data to identify patterns and themes relating to participants' sense of comfort. As a result, we distinguished 4 salient domains that shoppers related to their sense of comfort, which included providers failing to achieve sex-positive client interactions, stereotyped assumptions connected to the epidemiological and behavioral category of men who have sex with men, issues surrounding confidentiality and privacy, and testing situations where providers framed HIV as a personal choice. For our purposes, sex positivity refers to an accepting and affirming orientation to sex and sexuality. This orientation played into participants' sense of comfort in 1 of 2 ways. In one sense, shoppers described experiences where they felt judged by providers because of their sexual practices. As one shopper reported, He compared my partners of three since my last test to his one. He asked me why I had so many partners. In comparison to his one partner, he's like, well, I don't have as many partners as you. I've been monogamous. Well, not to judge you. Well, in that statement, you did judge me. It didn't feel very sex positive. I told him I don't use condoms when engaging in oral sex, and his reaction felt judgmental. He's like, why? I'm like, it seems hard to negotiate. He's like, no, just put it on him. The suggestion was inappropriate. End quote. Beyond judgment, several participants described situations where a provider talked about sex in a way that crossed professional boundaries, becoming sexually suggestive. As one shopper recounted, sometimes the test counselor was a little too personal for my liking. When I first met him, he told me I had great eyes. He asked me when the last time I had sex, and I said January, unfortunately. He left, hit my leg, and said, we should have just went to my house then, kidding. He was completely kidding, but it was still unprofessional, end quote. In both situations, clinicians frustrated participant notions of what it means to be sex positive. While in one instance demonstrated marked disapproval of sexual practices, the other showcased an accepting, although inappropriate, approach. In this light, sex positivity requires a balance of validation, respect, and professionalism in order to be effective. Another criterion that participants described in terms of their comfort was stereotyped assumptions that providers brought into testing sessions about the behavioral status of MSM. In one sense, this manifested as pre-existing notions about client sexual behavior, or as one participant described, the tester was very insensitive to LGBTQ concerns and was immediately judgmental about my infrequency of testing without asking me about my sexual habits. He chastised me for not having been tested in the 6 months, according to data in the system, and reminded me repeatedly that I was a high-risk demographic. He stressed the importance of condoms in a condescending way, assumed that I was having receptive anal intercourse, and even suggested that I wasn't using protection. Again, he did not ask. He told me, did not suggest, that we would need to do a full panel, throat swab, anal swab, genital inspection, because I was MSM, but backed off when I refused. Here, the unique sexual identity and behavioral characteristics of the shopper were lost to a stereotyped understanding of MSM that assumed high levels of risk without asking. Echoing his remarks, for some participants, the behavioral stereotypes led to coercion to accept multiple tests, or as another participant described, everything here was fine until I met with the nurse. I told her I had already gotten a syphilis test, and she said, not that I don't believe you, but if you don't have documentation, we have to test you for syphilis. And then she proceeded to tell me that it was because, with an attitude, that I'm a high-risk group for syphilis. She pretty much disregarded my wish not to get my blood drawn, so I asked her, so you're telling me if I don't get my blood drawn, I can't have a chlamydia or gonorrhea test? She went to go check with her supervisor and came back to tell me I could refuse to get my blood drawn. Also, prior, she offered to check the database to make sure I really had gotten tested for syphilis. I called her bluff, and she backed down. So whether assumed or not, in both scenarios, the designation of MSM worked to conflate sexual identity with behavior in order to create a quick lump-sum testing protocol. The streamlining process at times denied patient autonomy to choose which test they were interested in and became coercive. Without considering unique individual circumstances, relying on preconceived notions of MSM misses the diversity of YGB MSM experiences. Another element that participants related to their sense of comfort was confidentiality and privacy issues. In one situation, a participant described, it sounded like practitioners were on their lunch break as I waited in the treatment room to get my blood drawn, which was the last thing I had to get done. I could overhear what was going on in the hallway, and they seemed to be slightly disorganized and getting the materials to draw blood. I could hear someone say, I still have to draw his blood, but by the crowded meeting room, which made me think they don't keep things too confidential, end quote. Here, practitioners discussing client information with one another jeopardized the confidentiality of the session. In a similar situation, another participant recounted, she sent me to the bathroom for a urine sample. The pathway I had to walk through was being used for another testing consultation. And then I had to walk through the waiting room, which now had three people in it waiting. I urinated and had to carry the cup back through the waiting room and past the person getting the consultation again. End quote. In both cases, external parties were made aware of the shopper's testing session by not adhering to standards of confidentiality and privacy, leaving private information open to an audience wider than the intended counselor-client interaction. Bringing such information into public realms jeopardizes the trust and security required when discussing immensely private and sensitive topics, especially related to sex. One last domain that shoppers connected to their sense of comfort related to experiences where providers discussed HIV as an infection that people were personally responsible for acquiring. As one participant recalled, "Told me about medicines, case management, linkage to care, etc. HIV is a volunteer disease, not a victim disease. You choose to get HIV. I was given a no-nonsense kit to protect myself. I have no room to be careless," end quote. In this light, an individual, quote-unquote, chooses to become infected, or as another shopper described. Later in the session, the provider asked, "What would a positive test mean to you today?" To which I responded, "I would be devastated." The provider offered the following comment, "But you were having unprotected sex. You knew it was risky, so why would you be upset? You must not have been concerned about the consequences," end quote. In both scenarios, frame HIV risk behaviors as completely within individual control, making clients personally accountable for their potential of infection. At a conceptual level, HIV becomes infected with these providers' value-based understandings of responsibility and blame. Rather than acknowledge the structural and environmental factors that produce vulnerability to HIV, this reductionist perspective wrongly stigmatizes risk as something only for the irresponsible. So in lieu of these findings, I recommend that HIV STI screening centers offer confidential mechanisms for client feedback on services, mandate training on LGBTQ health and culture diversity in order to ensure sensitive and respectful encounters, encourage culturally humble clinical interactions to minimize reliance on stereotypes and assumptions, and conduct staff performance reviews to guarantee compliance with confidentiality and privacy standards. So before I close, I'd like to thank everyone who made this presentation possible, including our Get Connected collaborators, our youth and community advisory boards, along with Dr. Patricia Dittes, Gretchen Weiss, and our funders at CDC, MacAIDS, NACHO, and NIH. Thank you so much for your time.
I'd like to take the opportunity to commend all of the speakers for meeting their time limitations, which is not an easy task, as all of them were presenting actually incredibly interesting findings. And I think as a panel, this has been an extraordinarily valuable and interesting collection of research. I do think because they were so awesome in being able to maintain those time constraints that there is time available for questions. So let me just open up the floor.
It was across the board, any site that offered HIV STI like testing, and I think even if it was just HIV, but it had to be less than $60. Those sites that were like force tested weren't included, and testing couldn't cost more than $60. So yeah, it could be a community center, it could be an AIDS service organization, it could be a reproductive health center, Yep, a university health systems as well. Sure.
I was curious about your rationale for bifurcating the sample at 14. I was wondering about the characteristics of those who were under the age of 14 in terms of whether they were precocious sexually with peers or whether this was really a function of sexual abuse in terms of predicting.
Yeah, so I think our decision was, and I'm looking at my collaborator here who did the analysis, based on our understanding of the developmental literature. There were men in the study who actually reported sexual behaviors at much younger ages, at 6 and younger, who we did not include in the analysis. But these were behaviors that were not coercive, and we chose 14 as a starting point that we believe that the literature dictated to us as a good place to include.
Thank you very much for your comment and your question. The National Survey of Family Growth does provide race ethnicity options for Asian Pacific Islander. There are several others. Unfortunately for our data, it is the sample sizes were so small that there are limitations to what we're allowed to report when the cell sizes are so small. So we did have to do some of that lumping. But thank you very much for your comment, and I am sorry that there aren't more data to share.
My question is for Michael.
In terms of the next steps for intervention purposes, I actually, based on some of this data and some of our qualitative data, I wrote a couples-based program. It's a healthy relationships program for young male couples that incorporates aspects of HIV prevention and prevention of HIV transmission within dyads. I do think that it's very important that when you're considering a dyadic type of intervention, that you understand kind of the seriousness of that relationship. So we make a cutoff at the relationship had to have been together for at least 3 months. They have to consider that person to be their primary partner. Both members of the dyad have to consider each other to be primary partners, and they have to be sexually active. Because you're right, there is rapid primary partner turnover, especially as you get younger. So we make a cutoff at age 18 and above for YMSM. I think that when you get into the younger ages, it's important to take more of an individual level type of intervention that really addresses developing the skills to be able to navigate relationships. But it does become very challenging at younger ages to engage a couple in the long term, because the likelihood is that couple is just not going to be together at some point in the future.
You have really high retention rates in your study, which is amazing, especially for young Black women. Talk about what you did and what your study team did to keep those numbers in mind.
Sure. It's 100% our kind of research assistants and project coordinators being incredibly creative, persistent, and members of the community themselves. If we, as the PIs and faculty, were doing the retention, it would fall flat on its face. We do a lot of online retention, so we find people through their various Facebook profiles, which they often have 5 or 6 of them. You can pay to private message people on Facebook. You can pay $1 so that the message goes to their actual inbox rather than this side inbox that nobody actually seems to know about. And we just develop, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the people who are doing the interviews develop really amazing relationships with these young people, so really make sure that the experience that they have coming in is one in which they can really tell their story and feel heard. And I think for a lot of young people, this is the first time that they really feel like somebody cares about their experiences and their background, and so that keeps bringing them back. When we ask them what brings them back, it's routinely the name of the project coordinator. Yeah, we have actually. Our project coordinator is thinking through how to actually write a paper like that right now. Unfortunately, her time is spread across multiple cohort studies, so it's difficult for her to write a paper. these analyses that I presented today, it was a simple question about, is this a serious relationship or a casual partnership? And we define serious as someone that I've been together with for a while and that I care about more than other people. So it's a very loose definition of serious. In one of our other cohort studies, we provide 5 options. So a serious relationship, casually dating, sleeping with but not dating, friends, and anonymous. So that it kind of gives more of a spectrum of casual.
And were you able to look at those to see whether those serious partnerships were the same partners or were they different?
Sure, so we... The quite frankly, when we first started this longitudinal study, the idea was that we were going to follow these young people for a year, and then we kept getting additional funding, and so it's turned into the never-ending longitudinal study, which is now merging into another longitudinal study for another 5 years. And at the time, we didn't do a great job of actually detailing who those partners were at the beginning in order to be able to map them across all of the ways of data collection. We are doing that. We were recently awarded a UO1 from NIDA to merge our 3 cohorts into one for the next 5 years, and then they're bringing their serious partners into the cohort as well. So we're able to link the actual names of those people to one another and observe whether or not they are consistent over time or change over time. Sure. To be able to do that. In one of our other cohort studies, we got a supplement to do a social network supplement where we were able to look at the timing of all of their sexual partners throughout the course of the preceding year. And what's interesting is in this population, we actually don't see a lot of concurrency. I think part of that is perhaps regional differences. Midwesterners are a little different than New Yorkers. we work very closely with Jeff Parsons' group, and we routinely see these like very big differences and things like that. You know, our young people come in and say, I'm waiting to have sex until I get married. And that changes relatively quickly, but which is quite different from the experience in other areas of the country.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think one great outcome of the project was that the evaluations, which also includes the questionnaire, were offered to the HIV STI screening centers and whatnot. And my colleague Emily, she'll be presenting on that tomorrow. As far as how the feedback was received, and also talking about ways in which to improve client services based on the feedback and the evaluation that was done. But I think. Yeah, I don't necessarily know if there's a quick you can have this some sort of training protocol that will ever really be comprehensive enough to be now I know how to interact with every LGBTQ person in the world. But at least coming into it with this open mindedness and meeting somewhere where they're at and really trying to understand their individual circumstances to get at their unique behavioral risk profile, I guess, would be what I would say. But would make sure. sure to hear a talk for more like elaboration on that. Maybe.
Do we have time for one or two more questions, maybe? Let me toss in one. The data about the success of viral suppression and the kind of increasing use of PrEP, I think, seems to be among certain populations giving an inaccurate sense of confidence. And it seems to me that, unfortunately, the population that probably has least access to health care and the lowest viral suppression rates and least likely to be on PrEP might still get engulfed in that higher sense of confidence. Do you have any observations or thoughts about how those two are going to interact, or where are those variables heading?
I actually think the conversation about PrEP is a fascinating one, and I think that, you know, it's obviously, you know, these stories keep coming out every day, but it seems like, you know, we're dependent on biomedical interventions completely right now, and the people who are pushing PrEP are the people who also are telling us that treatment as prevention is not really working, right? So we have 25% viral suppression in this country, yet we're going to depend on this medication to, like, get it together. That's my, let me just say my bias there, sorry that. What we're seeing with our young men, and we just crunched the numbers the other day, and then we have this, you know, group that's not this, like, white middle-class group, is that, you know, some 25% have never heard of it, and we've defined it for them. And of the remaining 75%, a handful of them have actually, like, sought it out, right? So there's these conversations, I think, that are happening up here in these circles that are somehow not filtering down to those patients. And I think your concern about getting it in the hands of folks who are most at risk, who need it, is a real concern. And it's something we're struggling with on the Cuomo task force to try to figure out how to make that happen.
I mean, I think that the trickle down into popular media, or at least some aspects of popular media, is happening very, very rapidly, though. And information about PrEP is becoming more widely available. I think what we need generally is to be able to have clear and frank conversations with young people about what the actual benefits are of these medications, and how to balance that with other types of prevention strategies. And I think that ability to communicate directly with young people is not yet in place.
And how about a provocative sociological epidemiologic question? If you had a young MSM client that you were advising, would you tell them that there would be a higher risk, and no dodging this, by the way, would you tell them that there would be a lower risk for them to engage in sexual activity with someone who self-reports as being positive and undetectable, or someone whose status is unknown but claims a negative test that is 6 months or 9 months old, reflecting year-old data?
I say this all the time in my HIV class. I use that line, and my students will confirm this to me. I think there is a even in the context of incomplete viral suppression, there's something to be said about an MSM engaging this insect, a positive MSM, who is accessing healthcare, who is being checked out for STIs on a regular basis, who is probably on medication, maybe not perfectly adherent, that may make the risk, in my mind, if I was making that decision as a young HIV negative man, that's the direction I would go.
Anybody else?
I would say all of this, you're relying on self-report. So that, you know, you really need to make decisions based on what, you know, what your behaviors are and what preventative behaviors you're engaging in, whether that's use of PrEP, use of condoms. If you're in a relationship, I think that's a different story. And having clear communication with partners about adherence viral suppression.
I would keep them talking, because I feel like there's a lot of shutdown when it comes to information, and I think it took a lot of courage for young men to actually be open and talk, verbalizing the kind of sex they're having. And to your previous question, I just don't think there's a bridge right now. We're expecting people who are not engaged in medical care to be engaged for once because of one particular issue. And the cell isn't powerful. So I think we have to, like, really start thinking about the bridge between what we know here in these fancy circles and what's really happening in the community. Because that bridge, I don't see, is clear. And it happens, but it's not published, and it happens very socially. So I think that at least someone who's running a PrEP program for, like, minority men in the West neighborhoods, I'm noticing that there is a bridge,
comments? Anybody want to weigh in?
I think as an HIV test counselor, I would also, I think with your point, the former, I would say is if, like, you know, truthfully, like, admitted, then is, like, definitely, like, the lowest risk category. So.
Well, let me tell you, this panel has reminded me why I love this work. This has been a great exchange of brilliant minds sharing creative ideas and passionate work. So it's been a privilege to be the moderator. Thank you all for your attendance, and have a great rest of the day.